Today I'm interviewing some heroes of mine. Jim Walker and Shantae Marsh are a married couple who run the Big Car Collaborative in Indianapolis. The Big Car Collaborative has been around most of this century. They've gotten huge grants like Art Place in America type grants that are, and they have a tube factory art gallery, Listen Here sound art gallery. They have a radio station that's really great, and they've been reframing Garfield Park, which was a place that was endangered of a conventional gentrification, but they've actually made something really special out of it. And this is a very important interview to me.
Good morning.
Morning. How are you doing?
Good. Okay, how are you doing?
Good. Is it cold there at all? I'm curious.
No.
Florida. I talked to somebody in Omaha yesterday and told me it was really cold.
It's very hot. It's going to be like 80 here today.
Well, they said it was 90 and then it was like 47 the next day.
Yeah, it's weird times for everything.
Yeah, I actually just found out a friend of mine passed away yesterday.
I'm sorry.
He was 82 and he was Simeon Cox from Silver Apples. I don't know if you guys know the musician. And he made all these crazy synthesizers and all in the 60s. He was in Andy Warhol's factory. And
oh, wow.
But he ended up having a label. And he, in the late 90s, and my friend's band was on the label, and they toured with him. And he had an old RV, and he would park it in front of my place when he'd come to town. And like a super nice guy, though, like super. And like Andy Warhol had done a portrait of him, and he was just like this completely, hey, guys, let's get some tea. Like just very... like great stories too, you know,
yeah.
Crazy stories too. But I just interviewed him. I interviewed him 4 years ago, but I put the podcast out in June and he wasn't nearly as responsive. I said, hey, Simeon, I got this. And he's like, okay, thank you. And usually it was like way more. And then I found out he was sick though.
It's good that you got the interview in before he passed away.
Yeah. We did it in his backyard. We went to Alabama. He had a 36-foot sailboat, and he wanted to take us sailing, but he said that there was, like, the weather wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, man, I always just, like, wish he could have, because he loved to go sailing, too. And he's, like, this electronic music pioneer. Anyway, so I'm just, cool. I was just sitting there, like, looking at that, like, shit. So, you
know. I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah, I know that Jim and you, you know, had somebody, your mom just passed away. So.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks.
The 18th of August.
Yeah, my mom passed away 3 years ago, and it was just like, it's like the worst, because I saw her like 2 days before, though. We went at lunch, and so it wasn't like I didn't knew she was going to go.
Right.
But I had such a good time at lunch with her, and we were going to go to lunch in 2 days. And then, so anyway, yeah, okay. So how are you two doing?
Doing all right.
Yeah.
What are you guys like? It seems like you always have some kind of amazing new project coming on. I think my friend Chris Merritt said he might be doing something with you all too or something.
Yeah, Chris, we're working on a few different things where we're going to team up if it gets accepted by the city, and maybe on, we've been working at Monuments or at City Market. And he's got some ideas for them, so we're talking about that together with him.
You know, he lived in Orlando, right?
Do what?
That he lived in Orlando for a couple years?
Chris did?
Yeah, when he got out of college, he got a job in Orlando. And I was at Urban Rethink, the co-working, where I was the program director. And he, like, didn't know anybody. So he came in there one day, and we just ended up talking probably for a couple hours.
Yeah.
Like, we became friends and just... And he did a couple, we did a couple little things with, I feel like one of the things that we, like I sent to you and you did, I feel like he was involved in some of those or something like, and he, but he was the first one that told me about Big Car, the Big Car.
Yeah.
He was just like, hey, have you ever heard of this? And I started researching and just, so he sent me off on that. So.
It's great. Yeah. We really like Chris.
Yeah. He's good.
He's brilliant. He's an amazing guy. He's like, he's creative, and he also wants to do something good, so.
Right.
But what do you do? I know you had that thing about the giving the house, and is it Garfield Park, I guess, is what it?
We still have, rental houses here, and we have the home sales, and then we have a big building that's 44,000 square feet that we're fixing up that has a studios and event center and more, or event space and more exhibit space.
Yeah. So currently we have 20 properties and 15 buildings.
Oh,
on a block.
Were they from the block? You get them from the city?
Yes. We were really lucky when we were looking for a new space. We went to see this building that was just a terrible brownfield. And I walked in, I was like, this is not going to work. And Jim and I had moved to Garfield Park in 2000, and we purchased a home in 2010. And then, so we had been here, but never had seen this property that we ended up acquiring. So we, because there's a divide economically between the west side of Shelby Street and the east side of Shelby Street due to redlining. So like housing and property values never recovered. But we looked at this building on Shelby Street, walked out, and I just saw this huge, amazing building. It was like a compound. There were multiple buildings. The gate was open, so we all walked in. At the time, it was Jim and Tom Streit and I, and then we thought we'd do something like we did with Service Center, where we...
That was a project on the west side that I think you saw about when there was a... And they were just letting... Out there, they let us have it for free.
It was $150 a month. All we had to do was pay for trash removal.
And that was 12,000 square feet.
Yeah.
So we thought maybe that we could just use the space for a while, but then they ended up wanting to sell it to us. And then they gave us the bigger one.
George Seibert, who owned the building, grew up in Garfield Park, and he really wanted to see it return. And also, he was an arts philanthropist, so he had already helped support and build the Indianapolis Art Center. So the Indianapolis Art Center, which is, about seven miles away?
Yeah,
it's 7 miles away from where we currently are. George Seibert had helped support building a Michael Graves commissioned building in the Broad Ripple area of Indianapolis. And so when we gave him our information, he goes, oh, you have a proven track record. We're interested in, basically, he sold us Tube Factory for what it cost him to sell it to us with lawyers and
it was like what he could stuff. What they couldn't write off.
Yeah, whatever they couldn't write off as a loss. We
That because of the factory?
Tube Factory?
Yeah.
Tube Factory Art Space, which is the building that's currently...
That opened in 2016.
Yeah, it's currently renovated, and it's 12,000.
But the new one, that's 44,000 square feet, will 21.
Yeah, and George owned additional homes because he owned these factories, Aerofab, right?
Aerofab and Tube Processing.
He would a lot of times allow his employees to rent these homes that were right next door or walking distance to his factories. So when we were able to acquire those buildings, we also were able to acquire the housing,
five houses at once from him, from them.
Wow. So it was an actual Tube Factory till like when?
They moved out of there. 2000s. Yeah. It was just sitting empty for probably 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. So I think it was still operable into early 2000. And then
using it as a little bit of storage, but it was mainly vacant.
But as a factory, it was like a factory with workers until like early 2000s.
I interviewed, Scott Hawking.
One.
So we ended up talking for so long that I ended up dividing it. And I'm doing the second part coming out tomorrow. But we talked about baseball and told crazy stories to each other. I met him when I was in Detroit 4 years ago, and we had a bunch of mutual friends, and I just ended up meeting him at a party. And that we've just communicated ever since. He's great.
He is wonderful. I was lucky enough to get to work with him, and he was one of the first shows.
That's what I thought, yeah.
That we had at Tube Factory, and he was wonderful to work with, and really at that time, like the residency house that we had. So we had just, we just renovated Tube Factory, and the residency house, I was like, hey, Scott, we can put you up somewhere else if you want. But he stayed in this house, and it had a hole.
In the roof.
No, in the front of the house, under the.
Under that window, and we had. But he also, there was a hole in the roof, and a raccoon would get up in upstairs, and you would hear it every night, like rustling around.
Yeah, we joke about the house being haunted, but then also, like I said, we just had covered in tarp because at that point, I don't think we had the money to renovate that.
We haven't done that yet.
There was just this big hole under the front window of the home, covered in tarp, and I was like, but yeah, he was perfectly. Fine staying there, and
I can imagine him just being like, it's okay.
Yeah, he was really fun.
Yeah, they had I used to work at Nickelodeon from 94 to 2001, and there was a guy who had a gallery. He worked there, and he had a gallery, and it had studios he rented out, and then it somehow he got Rauschenberg to show there. It was like the mid-90s when Rauschenberg was like one of the most major, like probably one of the wealthiest artists in the world, and he got him because he was in Florida, but somehow he got him in there. And he, like, offered to send him to a hotel. And Rauschenberg's like, I don't need a hotel. And he slept on a barbie cot in the studio. Like, this is, like one of the most famous artists in the world. And there was, like, there's a bar that used to be, it's still there, but it's not the same. But it was known as the strongest, cheapest drinks in Orlando. And it was, like, one of the oldest bars in Orlando. Total dive. But everybody would go there. And it was across the street. And apparently he went there, like, every morning. Woman I know who rented a studio, and she's like, Rauschenberg said my art was really great. And then people said, he said the exact same thing to everybody else in the studio. So yeah, I know. It's kind of funny because Scott, I feel like he's becoming pretty well known, and it's just, I don't think he's going to change. He's not the art star. Or
he's probably one of the most thoughtful, like, well-rounded.
Yeah.
And educated, basically, he knows about so many different things. So he was just a real pleasure to work with. And
well, he told me he didn't know that much about art history. Then he started talking about it, and I go, what is it you don't know? You know?
Like, right, exactly.
Somebody brings something up, and he was just like, oh, yeah, this and that. And I go, everything that anybody's ever brought up, you knew about. So I don't know what this was, but he's funny like that too. And when I interviewed him, he insisted on starting where we left off at last time we talked. Let's just remember that story you told me about this. And he started telling me stories, and so the first 40 minutes is that. So that's why I decided to divide it up. But you all still have the radio station. I was actually listening to the radio station like here and there. I put it on, and
that's Jim's baby.
Is it?
Yeah. With Oreo Jones and some other people, and everybody doing their own shows. But yeah, that was something that just fell in our lap, that we could get an FM broadcast license. And it took a lot of work, but it wasn't anything we
Jim knew really we though had do. Like a vision for it, because you were listening to that one.
Kay Chung. I had read about that.
We went out to LA.
That there's a station called K-Chung in Los Angeles. And we read about it in the New York Times, I think. Mm-hmm. And then went out there and visited them. But it was like a community, an art radio station. And there's been, and also that Ubu Web.
Yeah, I looked at that a lot, yeah.
So, like, just thinking about how to combine those things into a radio broadcast format. And then the thing about that K-Chung station that's at broadcast out of Chinatown in L.A., old Chinatown in L.A., is that that one is a super low range, like way smaller range than ours, at least at first. And I think they got on AM. It was like a pirate station.
Right.
But the broadcast piece of it is way more, like, you get more immediacy out of that, and you get a lot more accidental listeners.
Uh-huh.
Like, we were driving around the other night, we went up to Dairy Queen to get some ice cream, and it was a nice night, so we had our windows down in our car, and we're listening to this show. This guy has a soul show, so we're listening to some soul music, and we drive right past another car, and they're listening to it too. And there were people we don't even know or anything.
I've listened to the soul show.
Yeah. So
there's a country one that I've listened to too.
Yeah. So it's pretty great that you can just, and then we put poems in the middle and then shows about artists and
Jim has a few shows.
Yeah, I usually just do a show for a while and then I do a different show. So I think the next show I'm going to do is about one song and then just spiraling from just choose one song and then talk about it and talk about everything else associated with it. Been a personal essay format, but also talking to other people and going, like, I've been really into Eric Satie. So just like pick an Eric Satie song and maybe hear different versions of it and then branch off into all the different stories about him and his music and then relate it to life and stuff like that. Right, that's what I'm going to do next.
That book, those books, 33 and a third, like about an album like that. I always
said, yeah, and there's a good documentary series that's like kind of maybe cheaply produced, but that I saw on Amazon where they just go and they'll do this one Peter Gabriel album and then it's like a documentary about how it was made and they talk to the musicians and stuff like that.
I was talking about that to me yesterday. I haven't seen
it. It's really good. The Peter Gabriel episode's amazing. Like there's other stuff on YouTube about how he made early music. We were talking about synthesizers. How he had this whole house. England, they have those, like a cottage or whatever. And he had this cottage that was basically like a huge studio with so many things. And then he was an early user of samplers and all kinds of audio collage. And that documentary showed how they came up with the bass line for certain songs and just where the samples came from. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I do too. I think you'd like the Simeon because he had a 1940s oscillator that he made into the synthesizer. And it's just like real, like kind of haunting, dreamy music. And he was 82 when he died, but he was like, he said that they were supposed to go on tour with Jimi Hendrix. And I can't remember what happened, but they didn't go. But it was like and he ended up in the factory. And he's just, I feel like he was more of an artist tinker or just kind of, like almost accidentally came up with an idea, and the music just sounds so, it's pop, but it sounds so dreamy and ethereal. It's like this, so I don't know.
That was what I was just thinking about with that. I don't know if you've read much about Eric Satie, but a lot of what? He went back to school when he was like 40 to learn how, had some classical training in music, but that was common back then. A lot of people could read sheet music and play piano.
Yeah.
At that point. But I think and a lot of what he wrote about was that and I think just one of the things about him is Brian Eno too. I think sometimes if you're too good at something, you're not really that creative about it. So like
Brian Eno always says he can't play any instruments.
Yeah. And the Velvet Underground is the kind of the same thing, and the Beatles, like from what I understand is they just handed a bass guitar to Paul McCartney and he was like, all right, what do I do with this? And then he had to figure it out. But they were focusing more on the art of it than the...
I think John Cale was like a real like trained musician, but everybody else was... I don't know if you ever watch those BBC music documentaries. Like I know you can watch them on YouTube, but there's one about Harry Parch. I don't know if you ever...
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, that's such a good one because he made all his own instruments, but he was like a hobo in the 30s. And he made his own instruments because he didn't have anything. So he like lived with the Navajos and all, but he was like not, he was like a white guy, and he ended up teaching at UC San Diego. And I don't think he ever went to college. And he made these like beautiful instruments and beautiful music, but he also used a lot of stuff from like Navajo sounds and stuff. And he was like bringing stuff from other, and he was, in the documentary, they talk about how he was a hobo, and I didn't really think about it, but he was gay, and he stayed being a hobo, I think, when he didn't really need to be a hobo, because there was, like, this gay kind of circuit where he could just be himself. Like, I never really thought about that was a way for, like, he said that certain, like, gay people would just stay there because they had their tribe, and I thought that, and his stuff is really, but those, there's a Krautrock one, too, and there's the Harry Parch, those are really cool, but the one you just told me about, actually, my friend was just telling me yesterday, you have to watch this. You have to go. It's like funny you bring that up. And how this, it's funny how like people will bring something up and then all of a sudden I'll probably hear about it again this week or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So wait, like before, because anybody's listening or anybody will be listening, can you explain Big Car and how it started and when it started and or what it is now?
It's a lot. Yeah, we can both do that a little bit together. So we, in 2000, Chate and I moved into an art, there was an arts area of the city at that point, just like getting started, called Fountain Square.
It was where the artists could afford to live, where a lot of times artists are the working poor, and it was the neighborhood that we could afford.
And they just opened a affordable housing art studio building, like a live and work art studio building in an old carburetor factory. So this was before we were married, so Chate qualified to live in there.
Based.
And yeah. So then we started, it had a theater in it. So we started doing multimedia performances and partnering with different artists like John Clark, who is another artist here in town. I don't know if you've ever met him. You might want to talk to him. He has a thing called Plop Lop, and he's a surrealist artist. And
what's it called?
Plop Lop.
Okay.
Like Max Ernst had this project called Lop Lop, or this thing called Lop Lop, which was the bird.
Yeah.
And John is very into Max Ernst. So both of us have sons named Max after Max Ernst, but John was working as a writer and a painter, and he's just an all around, like, I think you guys would hit it off really well because he loves like the Beat Generation, but he knows about contemporary art and all kinds of things, but
extremely knowledgeable.
So he was in on these multimedia performances with some other people because I was teaching creative writing then and meeting mainly adults because I taught like Saturday morning class, and it was a lot of adults going back to the IU campus here in town. So we all started doing a lot of things. Some of the people were musicians, some were writers, and some were visual artists, and some were other things. Just, there was a lawyer and different people who were interested in art and writing and music. So then we got, when we were in the Wheeler, we used it, but then Chate got pregnant and our first kid was born and we had to move out of that building. We got married. So then we got a studio and that was a Big Car. And so then the studio.
It was tiny. It was like 200 square feet.
It had been a bathroom.
Was that around 2000?
Yeah, this was about 2003 or 4 that we got the studio.
Probably 2002, because Big Car actually received federal like acknowledgement of our nonprofit status. We received it in 2004.
So we didn't get it wasn't final till 2006, but we applied in 2004. So yeah, so in between that, during that time, we started putting it all together. Then we were mainly focusing on bringing different art forms together, and we had a gallery. We expanded from that tiny space to a bigger space. And then, so at that point there was, and so Big Car was kind of named after a couple of things. And the idea of it was basically just that it's inclusive to all kinds of different folks and art forms. And so there's this Robert Creeley poem. It's about driving and watch the road and like in a big car. And so that Creeley poem was where it came from, the name. But it just was nonsense, basically. Yeah. We also thought about calling it Big Table because there was this surrealist publication called Big Table that was like a literary magazine. But we just never thought it would have any reason for anyone to understand what it meant in the future. And so then it just stuck. And then we started expanding. And then the recession hit. And then we started doing more urban, whatever you'd call that, city work in our neighborhood and working on things that would be like in the realm of urban planners and
sort of placemaking
and tactical urbanism and that kind of stuff. And so that's the direction that we went on one thread. And then we always kept the weird stuff and the experimental stuff on the other thread and have found a balance between us two crossing over between those things and also just the different folks that we've worked with, like artists like John and other artists who work in a community way and artists who work in weird ways. And we've done plays as a group. We've done created music together as a group, different folks. We've done a lot of visual art projects, public art projects, community building projects, community development projects, housing, all that stuff has happened by just basically being open to how it all feeds into making life better for and giving people the opportunity to be part of creativity.
So over years, I see our focus as on artists, and the reasons that we went into these different tangents are because housing, affordable housing, has always been a problem for artists and not being priced out of a neighborhood that they help revitalize. So even though some of these things might seem disconnected from an arts organization, overall, we are doing all these things with serving artists and with artists being the focal point. And when we say artists, we're talking about creators, we're talking about musicians. I consider hairdressers artists. And then there's different parts of the arts world. So there's more people who are focusing on hobby and might show their work in a coffee shop, or there's people who are going to be collected by museums. And I don't really discriminate against those two sorts of artists. And that's also why we have a gallery at Tube that commissions museum quality shows like Scott's. But then I might also show someone in a different gallery who wrote me a proposal that wants to show their paint by numbers, you know? So that's another thing, is trying to change the perception of the general public has of the artist, that they're moody, that they're elitist. And especially in a red state, you're up against all these perceptions as an artist. So a large part of Big Car is to create opportunities for all sorts of artists, to provide affordable housing for artists, because we really see, and if you think about it, the people, the world who are, you know, changing it, in my opinion, for the better, are artists, because they take risks. They're doing it. They're making choices based off of passion and love, not money, a lot of times. And so we want to keep artists in our city. We don't want them to move away. So that's, and so we want to create lots of different opportunities. We want to create opportunities for artists who might just be doing plein air. And we want to be creating opportunities for artists who might want to just stand in a mirror and masturbate for a video art piece. We want to take risks. We want to support risks. And then we also, the museum shows, I don't only show local artists. It's also artists who are doing things that I see as cutting edge, so that in contemporary art, so that people can see what's going on in maybe the East Coast, the West Coast, or Detroit in Scott Hawking's case. So they can look at how their work can fit. And especially if that's their goal, to become, to rise in the high art world. There aren't any galleries here that provide the opportunity that would go to Art Basel or Expo Chicago, or even
Art Basel.
Right.
Because I really encountered that when I had my gallery, where I was under a nonprofit. And prior to that, very more like hobbyist kind of art, and very conservative. And I changed that pretty quickly. I knew that they'd be like watching me, but I got a lot of what the hell is that thing in the window, like that thing. And then they realized that a bunch of people came in to see it, like, and especially like young people were into it. And they said, like, how come young people like you so much? I go, so like, it's just because I'm doing something relevant. It's not like dyeing my hair. They acted like there was a gimmick or something, and I said, no, it's just, I just aware of what's going on. And I said, they're actually told to calm down when they just got art school, and they're like, don't do that, because you'll never sell that. I would bring, do the same kind of thing where I try to bring somebody who was like museum type, and then bring somebody, because And I would mix like plein air with some contemporary installation, and somebody'd be, oh, I never thought about doing that, but it worked. Like when you see it, we're like, there's a something going on here that should be together, you know?
Yeah, we don't, like, because when you do separate things that way, the other thing that I've learned, like, with the audiences that we've had over the years is that it's also fun and okay to hate pieces of art. Like, it's okay to hate on art, and it's a safe, as long as it's not addressing super sensitive topics, it's okay if you don't like a piece and want to make fun of it or disagree with what the artist says.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. We've always worked in neighborhoods where a lot of times people didn't finish high school even. And so many times we'd have people wander in and they'd say, oh, I don't, and I'd be like, come on into the gallery, have a look around, let us know if you have any questions. And I'd be like, I don't belong here. Yeah. I didn't finish school. And I'd be like, that's not true. You do belong here. And what you think of these works, we want you to look at them. And we want, it's just as valuable as what anybody, even somebody who went to Harvard, thinks of these works. So
I actually thought, like when I had my gallery, I thought a lot about you all because I would have had this mindset anyway, but I was like, I want this to have really challenging art, but I also want it to be a community space where people can come in here. And I remember like somebody from the board came in and I was like, making coffee for these homeless people. Like they were like having sit down and I had some donuts and all. They're like, I said, no, they were just like out there and it was raining. And I said, come on in. And I just, but the lady that was like an older woman. And she was just like, I was afraid that you would call the police on me. And I said, you were like getting rained on. And I gave her an umbrella because people used to always leave umbrellas there. Like, and I'd have umbrellas there. And I said, here's an umbrella. And I told her, don't feel like you have to leave anytime. But it was funny because it was interesting how she was clearly uncomfortable with somebody coming in and even giving her a coffee. And so she'd be like, oh, they just want this. I said, this lady was like, felt so like she was intruding. There was like nothing about that was going on. But I used to flag her down when I'd see her in the street just so I'd make her realize that I don't know. She was like 75 years old and she was homeless. It was like,
you know. Yeah. You have to wonder what kind of country we are when we just allow people to be treated that way. I always do. And it's always been something that bothered me. When Jem and I were working on Spark at Monument Circle. So Monument Circle in Indianapolis is the heart of the city. And there's a big monument in the center to war. Which war was it? Is it the
1812?
I think it's the 1812 war. It's a war memorial that... So we're there and people are always coming down there to take pictures. Tourists are down there, but there's also a large homeless population. And when we were programming these activities, you know, what we had, how many programs? It was a 12-week period and we had hundreds of programs. We employed over 400 artists to do these programs and coordinate it. But there were times that the homeless population, there were a few that would help us set up in the morning and then want to take part in the activities, would play chess. It was really, they were so excited to have us there too, because people like would talk to them, would sit down and play chess with them, or they would be like, hey, will you play chess with me? Do you want to sketch this or make a collage with me? So they took part in our programs a lot of times, and it also helped people like that were working on the circle, that were taking part in the activities, see homeless people for being human and not as just ignoring them. They see them as people and not part of the scenery of living in a city.
I noticed too, like a lot of times, people that would come in that would be acting a little bit threatening. And my friend that worked for me, we'd be like, I just noticed like somebody else would be in there, you can't do it. They'd get all up, and the person who was being threatening would become more threatening. But my friend Matt, who worked with me, we were both pretty like even. I'd just be like, hey, what's going on? When the person was being threatening, we didn't act like they were being threatening. We were just like, hey, you want some coffee? What's, you know, we were just like, and it always, like they always stopped. But when mm-hmm. he like challenged them or asked them why they were doing that, they would get like more riled. But then they like sitting down and having coffee with us.
We had a few, we had a few instances, of course, that we couldn't de-escalate.
Like, oh, there's those.
Like I came into work one day to set up and there was a man throwing shit at me, but sitting in like, he was just from the onset and I, you know.
I mean, some people are just, there's something going on with right. them where you can't just talk them out of it. It takes more than
like mental illness and there's kind of
right. Oh yeah. And we're not, that's the other thing. I want to say, like with About Big Car and our mission, that we can't fix or solve everything. We're doing like the best we can. We also don't want to create a new stereotype for artists that it's their duty to fix all these issues. Yeah. What we're doing with our programming and everything is creating a platform for artists
yeah.
To interact with people of all types and then the audience to interact with people of all types. So,
but you might as well be part of being on the side of supporting
yeah.
things going in the right direction. And a lot of that for us came from just looking at social practice art that worked, because I think social practice art breaks down into a few different categories of what it is. And some of it's nice, cute stuff that I think is fine because it stays in a realm of not promising too much. And that is a comfort zone for some work. And I think it's fine. And I don't knock that at all. I think in between is work that is part of what a lot of our work is, which is part of being on this the team of people who are being proactive about our world and progressively approaching life. And then there's a more activist social practice art that is working directly with, for instance, an artist creating a program for the homeless or creating a program that is a social services thing. And also, I would not knock that stuff, but that's where you get into promises and you get into real life where you're, and we've been careful to not cross into social services or doing work where there are actual trained professionals who do that work. And that has been a line that we've been trying to walk just so that we don't overpromise and then let people down.
But we do sometimes let people down because people do, like when you start into these different areas where you're overlapping with community development, and like we did do like a Narcan training, and because we do like in the neighborhood we're in, we have just, there's one summer, like a man died behind one of our buildings of an overdose, and in the park, they were like, so the park is very close. They were dying in the park. And this isn't like quote unquote bad or unsafe neighborhood. It's just a neighborhood that has been caught in like into cyclic poverty. And this is a result of that. But
our art project isn't to save people.
Right.
I don't think that works.
We can't save people. We can.
It's probably end up saving people, but it wouldn't be. If that was your mission, it probably would backfire.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like a friendship could save a person.
It can. And sometimes giving an opportunity to somebody to
speak with each other.
Yeah, to connect with somebody, feel less lonely, or to be able to make art themselves. Because a lot of the work that we do does allow or encourage people to get creative themselves. So if they come into the space and there's an art exhibit, there's also a place for anybody of any age to also make something, even if they don't feel like they are any good at it. That doesn't matter. Like everybody, I think we have a difference in sometimes we have a difference in opinion about the idea of everybody is an artist. I think you have to think that you're an artist to be an artist. Like, you're not automatic. It's like everybody who is a songwriter is not necessarily a poet, because if they think they're a songwriter, not a poet, in my view. If it's if it was written to be a song, it's not written to be a poem. But that's a whole like argument that you can have. But everybody has the potential to be an artist, and everybody has the ability inside of them to think creatively and express themselves creatively. Like, it's not anything that anybody is devoid of.
Maybe I don't think everybody's an artist. Maybe I think everyone's a magician, because I think like humans as a species, we're like constantly changing things and taking a tree and turning it into a door and changing our bodies, or buying stuff is even changing something. And I think we forget about how that's a magic, how humans are magic. So I think maybe I think that humans are magicians. And then there are some who identify as artists, and the artists maybe hold up a mirror to the for us to look at ourselves more truthfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny how people will tell me, like, I had a friend who does amazing graphics, and he was making t-shirts for a long time, and I called him an artist, and he was like, oh, I'm not an artist, and I was like, everything he did was creative, and I go, what do you mean? He said, that's pretentious. I said, it's pretentious if you think it's pretentious. If you don't think it's pretentious, it's not pretentious. I said, you're an artist. I said, everything you do is like super creative, like everything. And I was like, you can't tell me you're not an artist.
People have this romantic idea that it's like, well, I'm not an artist unless I have oil paint in a studio and I'm tortured and
starving
and...
Yeah, he was actually making a lot of money on his, like, he was selling protest t-shirts. These were amazing. And he, like, make, like, good money on it. Now he's, like, flipping houses, but he bought them when the market died for nothing. And he, but he's, like, 45, and he's never, he hasn't worked for anybody since his early 20s. And I just, because he's always, and I said, the way you live is, you know, he lives, like, real humbly, like, in a place that's very inexpensive. And I think he has a lot more money than I think he does, or that he looks like he does, or something. But I always think it's funny how people are like, that there is that romantic thing that I just think, no, just ignore that. That's actually what makes you into a kind of a bad artist too, is if you think about that too much.
Do you know how many, like, Jim and I were joking one day, because I read a lot, and we both read a lot, but I read faster than him, so I go through more books, but we were talking about writers who write about writing or getting their MFAs or their, like, I get so tired of,
well,
of writers that I love who've written, like, bodies of work that I greatly admire, and then they'll come out with some short story about that it's just fucking boring.
I like writers who write about essays about... But then I'm a college dropout, so maybe I shouldn't be the one that says this, but
me too.
I was an English major, and then I dropped out after 2.5 years, and I went traveling. And it's funny, I'd apply for a job, and they'd be like, why did you quit college? I said, because I left the country for a couple of years. And it's interesting how some people will be like, that's amazing, or some people will be like, you should have finished your college degree, you know? And I'm like, I don't know. So what I got was, I can't imagine the college situation being better, but I like it when they write about, but now it feels like people will get MFAs because they want like a teaching job or something. And it seems sad to me that I feel like I'd want an MFA because I'd want to study with a particular artist or some artist or a group, but I wouldn't want to just do it because especially the job you're going to get is probably not going to, you know, be a great job. Like, you'll be an adjunct who's not making any money, and they're not treated with respect. And so it's just like the idea of when it becomes like when you're writing about being a careerist, I don't know if that's what you're talking about. Like
writing. Yeah, writing about writing isn't what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, so
that's what I thought you were saying, yeah.
But writing about the life of a writer nowadays, like the life of a writer, say Charles Bukowski, interesting, or Jack Kerouac, or William Burroughs, like those were interesting writers' lives. But the life of an academic writer now who's like,
no, I'm not.
I had the worst committee meeting today, and they're charging more for parking. It's like,
I was reading something with William Faulkner, and he said he learned to fly a plane, like, with his crop dusting, and he And he said that basically the education of a writer was like to just do as many things in life, experience as much of life as you can. And that's like my goal. Actually, one of the reasons I quit college, because I said I want to live a writer's life. And when I said that, I meant like I want to do everything. I want to experience life. And it's interesting when I was talking to somebody a bit younger the other day, and they were like talking to me about dealing with people, and I go, and how they read all this stuff and all. And I was like I've dealt with like so many kinds of cultures and kinds of people and kinds of like income, all just every kind. And I said, if there's anything that I'm good at, it's just like walking into a strange room, just being like, and just getting something going, being part of it or getting it. I said, my dad used to tell me that everybody's scared shitless of themselves and each other. Once you figure that out, life's pretty easy. And I thought, but a lot of times, like when you're just going for what you're saying, like the career, like you're reading people's writing, but you're not out there. You have to have a shitty job. You have to feel a bit threatened sometimes. I mean, maybe they'll feel threatened, but I'm saying you have to feel you're not really special, and you have to feel everything that I've learned is like way different when I go to this place or something. Like everything that I think is normal is not normal here, but they seem happy, or, you know, I don't know. It just seems, yeah, I know what you're saying though. It's just, I mean, I think I know what you're saying. But.
I do, like, I'm not anti-higher education at all.
No, because me neither.
Like, Jim's MFA from Warren Wilson, that was actually an amazing program, his low residency. Where he was directly working with Stephen Dobbins and
it was very helpful because it was very practical, and I did a lot of writing because of that work, and also expanded into other kinds of art. But I think that there were people who were famous writers, like, let's for instance, Hemingway is another one, like Faulkner, that didn't have to have a shitty job or anything, but they just went on, they made their life into an adventure in order to keep on having things to write about. I'm just going to go and hang around with the revolutionaries, or I'm going to, or just go and experience life. And I feel like the world of how it works for writers now has put them into this place that's boring. And
I say shitty job, I might be more like, environment where nobody gives a shit about your education or what you can do, like that kind of job where nobody's really impressed unless you help me finish this thing we have to do at work, or like I don't mean like necessarily like shitty job, but a shit job where you're not really that important here, you know, because that's not important because we're working right now. And I just feel like that kind of thing where, like, I remember I had a construction job when I was in my early 20s. And at lunch, I went off like around the corner at lunch. I had brought my lunch and I was reading a Shakespeare play. And all these guys were like, some guy saw me. And I was like trying not to let anybody see me. So they started calling me Shakespeare. But I remember, or they called me college boy. And I was like, I wasn't in college or anything. But it was funny because I actually got along pretty well with all of them. But because they called me Shakespeare. I thought it was hilarious. And I just be like, I just kind of went along with it and was just like, and I'm a big guy and I was strong enough. So I wasn't like, I was doing whatever I had to do. So if I wasn't doing my job, they'd be like, it would probably become a humiliating situation. But since I could pick things up or whatever, I was like, oh,
you're all right.
Yeah, whatever. But I'm all for higher education, but I do think about it. A lot of times an artist would come in and see me and tell me what they got in their MFA or what they studied, but they weren't even given like any sort of practical knowledge of being an entrepreneurial or like an independent artist. Or I felt like, why isn't that just, it would be like your option is either to sell your paintings or become a teacher. And it would be like, or both, but it would be like, why? And I know a lot of people in the arts that actually make decent livings, but they're usually like graphic design or something like this, or in design, some kind of design, but there's no, I don't feel like there's a lot of possibilities that are given. Like, I'm not in there, but from what people tell me.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we first started having interns from Heron School of Art, I remember we were good friends with one of the professors named Flounder Lee. And I was like, Flounder, these interns, like, they don't know how to do anything. I was like, what are you teaching them? And he goes, I have to teach them how to think. And he was right, because another thing that's happening with our education system right now is there's kids are beaten down and their creativities by the time they graduate, it's just from high school. They just don't have a lot of creativity. They don't want to take risks or put themselves out there or even speak up in class.
Like, analytical thinking is de-incentivized and all through school because of testing, and also because of controlling. Yeah. It's basically like schools are testing machines that they try to keep secure. So it's about security and about results.
Yeah.
And so thinking analytically and asking why is like why they don't want you to do that when you're on the football team or in the military. Like, they want you to just do what you're supposed to do, not ask why and not spend a lot of time. And then when they get ready to graduate from high school and they go to college, then everybody's like, start thinking analytically. And the kids are like, I don't even know how to do that now.
I notice a lot of times when I'll see a lot of artists and I'll say, you can do, I've talked to younger people too and go, like, seeing their stuff. I said, hey, do you want to do an installation in the gallery? And some people are like, just go in. And then there's some that are just like, what do you want me to do? And I was like, based on all this stuff, I said, and I'll give them some kind of framework. I said, and then some people will just be like almost panic stricken. Like, well, what do I do now? And I said, based on everything else you've done, you don't really need me. But I'm just like, I'll tell you like where you can do it. But I said, if you want me to, and then I end up giving them a little bit, like almost like giving them what they already have, just telling them like, oh, you can do this. And I go, it's already like something that's in your, like you've been doing, but I'm just like reminding you that it's okay. That's kind of what it was. And it's
because that confidence has been taken away or never encouraged. And so then people have to have somebody that says, you can do it. You can just go ahead and do it. You don't need to worry about it so much or be scared of it.
Yeah.
That is
One great thing like that Jim always does that I've appreciated over the years. Because we're an arts organization, we always have a really young staff that works with us or for us. And he's always been really great about including like asking them like questions about what they think, including them in like major decisions and like really build, I feel like he's been responsible for building a lot of confidence and just helping them be confident in what they think. Because a lot of times people aren't given that sort of freedom in a job. They're not invested in the way that we try to invest in.
The idea of teaching confidence is actually, because I remember a friend of mine said that the most important thing was for a kid is to instill confidence. And it feels like things like just telling people the things that are just when people are like, oh, you're doing a great job and all, but that's not going to do it. If you're somebody close to you, like your spouse or your parents or something, say you're doing a great job if they tell you're not doing a great job, it really hits you harder, but there's ways where you have to prove yourself to yourself. I don't know how to teach that, but I'm sure like a lot of things you all are doing in the community end up doing that for people.
It's like a sports thing. When you start to when you do something that, like I like baseball. So if you intend to do something and then you're like, I'm going to hit this next pitch down the third base line.
Yeah.
So the ball comes in and you hit that, you actually do it. There's so many factors involved in the ability to do that. Then you are like, I just did that. You don't need a coach to say, nice job hitting it down the third base line, because they might not even have known you wanted to do that, but you did it. Then the next time you come up to bat, you're like, I know I could do that. I just did it. And that's the same thing with anything.
Yeah. I'm a baseball fanatic. And I was like, we lived in Detroit when I was a kid. And the fourth grade, I played Little League for the first time. I was just terrible. Like, the first 15 times I struck out, and I was like, I just, like, didn't know. And the coach would be like, choke up. Everybody would tell you advice, but And I would just do what they said, but I didn't really know why I was doing it. And then in between, like in the winter, I read this like really comprehensive baseball book that was like written in the probably the 1930s or I don't know, but it was by Connie Mack, the famous baseball manager. But it was super comprehensive, and I don't think it was really like a kid kind of book, but it broke down everything and like why and everything. And I was like, oh, it made sense to me. And the first game in the fifth grade, I hit 3 home runs. And but then the other thing is I got to that place, but then a couple years later, I had bad habits because I thought I knew everything. Like redo it. But it was like it took me a while to figure that out, like that I was like striking out too much or something. And I almost needed a mentor to tell me like, oh yeah, you figured this part out, but like at the next level, you're going to have this problem. I didn't really, it took me a little while to, and sometimes I figured out after it was done. So it was like, but it was like, I do remember thinking that after I read this, I thought these coaches are giving advice and they have no idea what they're talking about, but they're just like something. And I remember telling the coach, you don't know what you're talking about. I was like in the fifth grade. I'm really mad because I said it, but I'd done really well. And he was like, told my parents that I was, and my dad was like, Pat probably does know what he's talking about. That's what he said to him. He said, let him do it. He said it. He said he's probably researched it or done something, you know? And I go, but it is like true because there's also, yeah, like the developmental part of it. Like you learn one step and then all of a sudden somebody's starting to throw like breaking pitches and you don't know how to hit that. And there's things that like, if there's somebody that was like around you to kind of keep an eye on you and tell you like, oh yeah, this is why this isn't working now. So we were talking, a friend of mine were talking about when you're a kid and they put you in a gifted program and they tell you you're brilliant and all of a sudden you just quit doing your homework or something too. There's that too. So there's like, you want confidence, but you also want responsibility too, you know? So,
yeah. It's a balance.
Yeah. And
so Shate has to go.
Actually, I'm going to have lunch with one of a mutual friend.
Remember Jeremy who came to visit?
Yeah, I was going to mention him because we all had dinner. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's who she's going to go.
We're going to have lunch.
Kim, my ex, told me to say hello to you.
Yeah. So we could do more. We could talk more if you want, or if you got enough, we could do another one.
Maybe just like wrap it up a little. I'm just going real quick, but it's
yeah.
I just want to know like what you all have, like your plan is now and what's good, like what's like, how do you plan on evolving or just keeping what you're doing or that kind of thing? Like,
yeah. Expanding the new buildings is a big part and that should open next year. So that'll have studios, all the houses filled with artists and a public green space and then continuing to work on extra stuff on the radio station. Those are our next big things, and having this block, which is very unique anywhere in the world, where you have 16 buildings all in one block, all connected together. And just right now we're in the middle of all the, or we're at the start of all the construction. Uh-huh. So then it'll take a little while. So it's actually not bad for us to be, even though we wish we weren't, but to be closed for safety while we're in the middle of this transition, then we can open back up and hopefully everybody will be able to gather in a healthy way and use the space for what we hope to have it, just all kinds of art, people together and food and everything else.
Yeah, yeah. Shante, if you have to go, I just wanted to get a little bit of a, you know.
Yeah, so I think one thing we still have to figure out, we've been very lucky. We want to be able to survive as an organization. So we're always, one thing that's worked in our favor over the years, because our mission is like serving artists and revolves around artists, is that we can respond pretty quickly to whatever we need to. And mainly we have a very supportive board, but we don't have an endowment. So each year we start from nothing and have to fundraise currently over around like $800,000. So it's very daunting. And when we have these buildings, hopefully we'll be able to, that it will help us. These are supposed to be income generating, especially the artist studios that we'll charge for. But yeah, long-term, I'd like a little security for our organization and our commissioning program. And we also have a major project tied in to New Harmony, Indiana, which is just fascinating because what we're doing now has very utopic leanings. And so New Harmony, Indiana was the site of two utopias, and we did a lot of research about communal living and architecture and how that influences how people interact with each other. So we're just constantly trying to pull all these tendrils together, and we'll see how it all shakes out.
No, I'd love to visit you all someday. I'm surprised I haven't.
Yeah,
let us know because we can definitely put you up here.
I've been to Detroit and visited, and I don't know if it's Gina Reichert or Mitch Copins or any of them, but they're friends with Scott.
Oh, yeah.
They used to go by Design 99 or Powerhouse Productions.
Yeah, we know their work.
I'll see you guys. Nice to talk to you.
I should probably go too. I need to get ready for some things to do here after lunch. But if you need any more stuff from us, just let us know. It might be interesting to air some of these on the radio. Are they an hour or longer?
I was thinking actually the Simeon Cox, the guy that died yesterday. I have the interview with him is we have to see how long it is, but it's really good, and it sounds really good, and it's 49 minutes, but I interviewed him in 2016, but I could send you some stuff about him, but it might be good because he just passed away too.
Yeah. Let me talk to Sean about it. And I think that it would be fine for us to just to plug these in.
Scott
Hawking would be good.
I'm going to put the second part of his up for tomorrow because the first part is like 40 minutes. The second part's an hour. So it's,
yeah. I think that'd be good. Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk more about that, Pat.
Thank you for listening to From the Desk of Pat Green. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. I'd love to hear some feedback. And if you enjoy it, please share it. And also feel free to subscribe because we're on Anchor and we're on Spotify, Apple, and several other Google. Just keep looking. We're there.